There is a theory, which is quite a serious academic theory, that civilization began with beer, and the protagonist of that theory is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and his argument is that mankind stopped being hunters and gatherers and settled into live-in organized communities in order to grow crops, and the first crops were grains, and those grains were used, the reason they grew those crops was to make beer. And there is quite a lot of archaeological evidence to suggest that that is true, that man lived by beer alone before he lived by bread alone. And we're talking about Mesopotamia about 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, or possibly a little earlier than that. There's also been some very recent work at the University of Pennsylvania in which they took traces of shards of pottery, and they analyzed them and began to think that this was beer sediment that was 4,000 or 5,000 years old. And they actually went to a local brewery, the Dock Street Brewery in Philadelphia, and said, you know, what kind of sediment do you get on the inside of your vessels? Could we have some and take a look at it? And they discovered that the sediment that's forming on the inside of brewing vessels in Philadelphia today is remarkably similar to the sediment that they found in vessels from Mesopotamia 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. So there's a lot to support that theory. In ancient Roman times, the writers, or the journalists of that period, if you like, people like Julius Caesar and Tacitus, who were used to wine in Rome, because Rome's in the warm grape-growing part of Europe, when they went north to places like modern-day Germany and Belgium and northern France and Britain, they observed that the people in the north drank something different made from grain. They drank something that they called cerveza, which is still the word that the Spanish use for beer, of course. So the ancient Roman civilization certainly knew a great deal about beer. Then you have the Dark Ages, really, and after the Dark Ages, after the time when Vandals were raging all over Europe, and Europe emerged from the Dark Ages, the monks of the beginning of this millennium, people like St. Columbus from Ireland, helped to establish breweries. And breweries were, well, really, I suppose, the centers of all kind of civilized life in the period immediately after the Dark Ages were monasteries. I mean, a monastery was a sort of university and a school and an inn. And that's where beer was made. And there's a tremendous history of monastic brewing, and there still are quite a number of monasteries in Europe that still do brew beer, and they brew beer commercially. After the period when the monks ran the brewing industry, various kings and dukes decided that this seemed a pretty good, too profitable to let the monks do it, and a number of royal families began to establish breweries. And if you today buy an American beer called Budweiser. Budweiser took its name from the Czech town of Budweis, and in the year 1200, the Czech town of Budweis was where the Royal Court Brewery of Czechoslovakia was. And during that period and the medieval period, there were many breweries owned by royal families, and there still are a number of breweries in Europe that are owned by royal families.
The Budweiser brewery in Czechoslovakia is now targeted for takeover by Anheuser-Busch, isn't it?
Well, Anheuser-Busch in the United States would like to take over Budweiser in Czechoslovakia to resolve the endless trademark dispute between the two companies. It's actually quite a complicated trademark dispute, because there is no question at all that Anheuser-Busch took the name Budweiser from the European town of Budweis. But the particular brewery in Budweis that is using that name in Europe was actually founded a little after Anheuser-Busch. Not long after, but it was certainly Anheuser-Busch was making a beer called Budweiser in St. Louis, Missouri, before the actual present, you know, we're talking about the arrangement of kettles and so forth that exists in Budweis today. It was, I think, Anheuser-Busch was 1876, and the present Budweiser brewery was in the 1890s, from my memory. But in the town of Budweis, there had been breweries since the 1200s. So you have to also realize that industrial capitalism didn't begin until, at the very earliest, the early 1700s, where it began in Britain. And really, the idea of brewing as a commercial industry really dates from that period in the early 1700s in Britain. Some of the oldest breweries in Britain still do date from that period, Whitbread being a very famous British brewery that dates from the 1700s. And really, beer in the sort of beer that we could take off the shelf today and recognize as beer, you could really say that porters, which are still made in the United States, the oldest brewery in the United States is a brewery, again, in Pennsylvania, as it happens, one called Youngling in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. They make a porter. Porter is a dark, roasty style of beer that dates from the early 1700s. Pale ales date from the early 1800s. Golden lagers, which most American beers are, date from Pilsen and Budweiss in the early to mid 1800s. So beer as we would recognize it comes from the 1700s and 1800s.
Now, where does light beer come from?
Light beer is something that I find hard to take seriously. I mean, American beer is already very light. And when breweries said we're going to make something called light beer, it struck me rather as though Volkswagen cars were going to say, now we're going to make a compact. Light beer was actually invented. If one can dignify such a sort of prostitution of a product with any serious discussion, it was first made in the United States by a company called Gablinger, which has now gone out of business. Of course, it was really commercially made popular by Miller. In, I guess that was the late 1970s, early 80s, it really began to take off. Whenever I see anybody drinking light beer, they nearly always sitting on a bar stool in an airport lounge drinking light beer and stuffing their face with taco chips, and I can never really understand that, because there are more calories in one taco chip than there is in a bottle of beer.
Your forthcoming book, Beer Companion, due out later this year, includes a section called A Wine Lover's Guide to Beer. Give us a little preview.
Yes, the reason that I thought it would be a good idea to have A Wine Lover's Guide to Beer is that curiously enough, I mean, it is curious when you consider that far more beer is drunk than wine, whether we're talking about North America or Europe or the whole of the world, far more beer is drunk than wine. But there's far more knowledge of wine. An awful lot of people do know the difference between a red wine and a white wine and a still wine and a sparkling wine and a dry one and a sweet one and a red one from France and a red one from California, one from Bordeaux, one from Burgundy. And people don't appreciate that same range of characteristics exists within beers. I mean, most people, if you imagine somebody who's only ever drunk Chablis, most beer drinkers are in that situation. They've only drunk the Chablis of the beer world, the very light golden lager that's a distant derivative of Pilsner lager. That's what 99% of beer consumed in the United States and in many parts of the world is. So what I've tried to do in the Wine Lover's Guide to Beer, I've said, well, you know, you understand the Chablis, okay, that's where everyday beer fits in. You understand that there's something different, which is Chardonnay. Well, the Chardonnay of the beer world is a true, proper, serious Pilsner beer. The Cabernet of the beer world is an English pale ale. The Gewürztraminer of the beer world is a spicy Vienna-style darker lager. The Amontillado sherry of the beer world is a dry stout, like Guinness or Murphy, and so on. That's the system that this. It's fairly light-hearted. I'm not saying these products taste the same, but I'm trying to help people understand that there are different beers for different moments and different moods, and different beers for different foods. And if you understand wines a little bit, you can make some comparisons with beers.
Do you have any basic rules, like golden lager with fish and porter with red meat?
Well, I mean, you laugh, but I think you can look at it this way. I mean, one of the reasons that people don't get the full enjoyment that they could get out of beer is because they misunderstand beer. A lot of people think that beer is just something you drink when you're feeling hot, when you've mowed the lawn. Well, most of the well-known beers are lawn-mowing beers, you know, but there are beers for other moments. And, I mean, if you were having oysters on the half shell, you have those with a dry stout like Guinness, and that's just a fantastic combination. If you are having a white fish, then I would indeed recommend a very dry Pilsner beer like Pilsner Urquell from Czechoslovakia. There are one or two beers of that type now being made in the United States too. If you are having red meat, I'd certainly recommend an English pale ale.
I've been to one of your beer tastings where you cited the fact that people will walk into a bar or a restaurant and just say, "Give me a beer," without specifying what kind or what brand they would like.
And nobody would go into a restaurant and say, you know, the waiter comes along to you in the restaurant, you don't say, bring me a plate of food, please. I mean, you know, you tell him what kind of food you have in mind. Nobody really says, give me a glass of wine. I mean, at the very least, they distinguish between white and red and dry and sweet. But people do say, give me a beer. And if you say, I say to people, look, I'm a tremendous beer lover. I've devoted the last 15 or 20 years of my life predominantly to writing about my love of beer, but I never ask for a beer. You know, never ever go into a bar and ask for a beer, because they'll give you the most ordinary product that they have.
In the in that 15 or 20 years, you've written the New World Guide to Beer and the Pocket Guide to Beer, and now you have the Beer Companion coming out. How is the Beer Companion going to be different from those other previous releases?
The Beer Companion deals with the world's greatest beers. It really focuses in very strongly on the world's greatest beers. There's a lot of there are profiles, quite detailed profiles of about 200. Classic beers. They're very, very personal profiles. It's a companion in the sense that I take you, the reader, with me to visit these breweries and tell you what it's like there, what it's, how they make the beer, what the place is like, how they drink it in that country, and how they, if you like, how they use the beer. And I also talk a lot about beer with food. This is something of a passion of mine. I also do love wine, and I don't for one moment suggest that people should stop drinking wine with food, but I do think that you should consider, when you're making a meal, is this a meal that cries out for wine, or is this a meal that beer might be more fun to have with? I think one reason that people, even if they have that thought, very often people finish up not having beer because they think it's too bulky to drink with food. But that's sort of based on the assumption that you have you drink beer out of a large glass, and there's really no reason why, you know, if you and your partner are having dinner, you don't actually have to have a whole big glass of a different beer with every course. But, you know, you can open a bottle and share it between you in a reasonable sized wine glass and have that type of beer with that course, and then for the next course, well, let's open another bottle and of another style, and let's see how this one goes down.
Some very general questions. I'd like to start with pouring beer. Some people pour down the side, some down the middle, and many just drink right from the bottle. Is there a proper method or technique?
Well, I suppose there are moments when you just feel like drinking from the bottle when you're on a fishing trip or something like that. But if you drink beer from the bottle, you don't really get the full character of the beer, because you don't get any of the aroma of the beer. And beer is very, very aromatic. I mean, even the most ordinary everyday beers, they may have as many as 8 or 9 different varieties of hops that are put in there to give them the very flowery aroma they have. So if you're really going to enjoy beer to the full, you should drink it out of a glass rather than a bottle or a can, and ideally a glass that curves in a bit at the top just to retain some of the aroma. So a good-sized wine glass is very, very nice for drinking beer out of. When it comes to pouring beer, some breweries recommend that you start off pouring quite vigorously so that you begin to build a head. And then as the beer foams, then you tilt the glass and pour down the side so that you don't finish up with an ice cream sundae. I don't think it ought to be necessary, really, to start dumping it in the middle of the glass. But some beers, it is necessary to do that. Shouldn't be. There should be enough natural carbonation for that not to be necessary. But certainly, you either finish up pouring it down the side, or you do the whole of the pour down the side. The amount of foam that most beers should have is about if you put two fingers along the rim of the glass, it should be about that sort of depth, like the old, give me two fingers of rye.
Okay, it's summertime, I've mowed the lawn, I'm going to throw a couple of Coors Lights into the freezer and get them real cold. on the other hand, maybe I'll have a glass of that British stout, and they say that should be room temperature.
Now, when people say room temperature, it's a bit like with wine. It shouldn't be room temperature. It should be a natural cellar temperature.
Well, room temperature if you live in a castle, I suppose.
Yes, exactly, yes. I mean, it never was meant to be central heated room temperature, but it's all to do with the way in which the beer is made. Lager beers are made with a very cold fermentation and maturation, and therefore should be served chilled. Ales, porters, and stouts are made with a warmer fermentation and maturation, and therefore express their flavors more fully if they're served, say, in the middle, lower to middle 50s. Very much the way that you would treat a red wine.
Okay. A little on the difference between U.S. ales and especially modern-day brews and the traditional or British ales.
Well, the first brewers in the United States were mainly British, and they made ales. And over the years, they gradually made these ales less and less tasty until most of the, insofar as there are still big brewers making ales in the U.S., and most of those are in the northeast of the country, their ales are hard to distinguish from their lagers. There's hardly any difference. It's just a very slightly more fruity taste to them. But the new microbrewers and brew pubs, some of them are making incredibly distinctive ales, very often more distinctive than the ones in Europe. I mean, a lot of the most distinctive and most interesting beers in the world are now being made in the United States.
Miller is now coming out with a whole campaign, Taste the Difference That Barley Makes.
Well, beer is meant to be made with barley, so I don't know what they've been making it with so far. I suspect they've been using a heck of a lot of corn, and corn. For years and years, American brewers, and not only American brewers, I mean, this is true of some brewers in Europe too, have, instead of being making their beer entirely from barley malt, which is a traditional ingredient, they've been using 10, 20, 30, 40% corn or rice. And they've said, this makes better beer because it's lighter and crisper. It's certainly lighter, I'm not sure whether it's crisper. And now the consumers there are consumers who are beginning to demand something with a bit more flavor. So now some of these brewers are rediscovering what beer should have been made of all along.
Those other grains are also cheaper, aren't they?
They are, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's argued that on Budweiser, some of the promotions for Budweiser say that rice is more expensive. They don't say more expensive than what. It's more expensive than corn. But rice and corn are both cheaper substitutes for barley malt. Barley malt and sometimes wheat malt are the traditional grains from which beer is made.
How does one become a beer expert?
My background is that I began my working life as a newspaper journalist 35 years ago, at the age of 16, on a small town paper. And in those days, journalists drank one heck of a lot of beer, much, much more than they do today. And they all seemed to love it, and they all talked about the beer that they had in different cities, but they never wrote stories about it. They drank all this beer, they talked about it, they went back to their office and they wrote rather pompous articles about wine. And I always felt that somebody should be really making the case for beer. Beer was as complex, as varied, as noble, as interesting as wine. So I started writing the odd article. And really, from writing the odd article, that it took over, the story took over my life. It was sort of like being one of those detectives, a Philip Marlowe type detective who gets on a case, and it seems a pretty simple case at first, and 70,000 words later, he's become one of the central characters in his own case. That happened to me about 15 or 20 years ago, and I've written about nothing but malt beverages since then.
Do you ever have concerns about overdoing it, consuming too much alcohol, or developing a problem with it?
I have never worried myself that I would develop a problem. I think that I enjoy the taste of beer too much to want to be in a situation where I'm no longer really tasting it and enjoying it for what it is. I'm very strongly in favor of people being discriminating when they drink. That's really what my whole oeuvre of writing is all about. It's about discriminating drinking, which in my view is exactly the opposite to indiscriminate drinking. I mean, I wouldn't want to sound po-faced about that. Everybody, when they're a student, everybody has some fun, and people should have fun, and life can't be totally risk-free. But the real enjoyment of beer or of whiskey or of any alcoholic drinks is in the appreciation of them, and you don't appreciate them if you're just slamming them back.
Yeah, that's basically everything I had. The tape is still running. Is there something we haven't covered that you'd like to make sure we try to get on the air?
Well, I think we've covered most of the points. When we were talking about food, beer and food, you know, people do always make the assumption that wine is what you have with food. There are actually some foods that wine just can't hack, you just can't deal with. I mean, one that's a rather, perhaps a rather obscure example, but a monk in a monastic brewery once said to me, challengingly, I thought this was quite funny because this gentleman was a Trappist monk who was supposed to lead a life of tremendous denial, and he said to me, "Mr. Jackson, can you tell me what wine you would drink with asparagus?" While I scratched my head over this, he said, "There's no need to scratch your head, Mr. Jackson. There is no wine that can be drunk with asparagus. What you have to drink with asparagus is beer." And I thought about that, and of course that is, it is true that all over Europe, in the asparagus-growing areas in Alsace and Switzerland and southern Germany, in the season when asparagus is fresh, it's a huge ritual. Everybody has these wonderful feasts of asparagus with scrambled eggs and ham, and they always wash it down with beer. And I even wondered why that, and partly it's just to do with where things are grown. You know, I mean, the foods that are grown in warm countries, where they grow grapes, those foods tend to go with wine. And the foods that are grown in cooler places where they grow grain, those foods tend to go better with beer. But there are also even some exceptions to that. I mean, the one that I often think about is chocolate. I mean, it's very, very hard to find any wine that will accompany chocolate. Now, okay, if you're eating a bar of chocolate, you don't want any wine anyway. But, you know, if you're having a chocolate dessert, you're having death by chocolate or something like that. What are you going to drink with it in the way of wine? Maybe something really obscure like a Madeira or Malmsey or something like that. But if you have a very strong Bock beer or a very sweet stout or very rich porter, those types of beers, which actually have a type of malt in them that's known as chocolate malt because it tastes so much like chocolate, they're the perfect accompaniment to chocolate. So that there are some foods that really cry out to be accompanied by beer, and where wine just won't do the job.
I like Watney's Cream Stout as a dessert beer. Generally, it's real sweet.
Well, Watney's Cream Stout is a good example of the sort of beer that you could have with a chocolatey dessert. And the Sam Adams Boston Lager people have just made a cream stout as well, which is very rich and creamy. I mean, I wouldn't suggest a dry stout like Guinness with chocolate. I would suggest a dry stout like Guinness with oysters or clams or shellfish of some kind.
I usually serve a beer with the salad course also, since you can't mix the vinegar with the wine.
A beer with salads is an interesting idea. I've even used the very, very tart, acidic types of beers, some of the Belgian or German wheat beers or lambic beers, which are quite hard to find. I've used some of those in vinaigrettes sometimes. But if I'm having, I'll tell you, a very nice combination is a very nutty type of salad. If you, you know, perhaps you've used hazelnut oil or some kind of nut oil, and maybe you've put some walnuts in the salad. Maybe it's a Waldorf salad, a crunchy, nutty salad. A brown ale, like Newcastle brown ale from England or Brooklyn brown ale from the United States, because the nuttiness, again, it's a question of the type of malt that's used in those products. The type of malt that they use, which is called crystal malt, is actually a sort of crunchy, nutty kind of malt, and it gives a crunchy, nutty flavour to the beer, if you can imagine beer having a crunchy flavour. And it goes very well with crunchy, nutty salads. In my new beer companion, when I talk about beer with food, I never, I hope, just say, well, you could try this with this, or, gee, this goes well together. I always try to explain why these things go together. Sometimes it might be a question of provenance. It might be that they're grown in the same places, and they become a sort of part of a kind of integrated cuisine, like drinking beer with asparagus in Alsace. But other times it's to do with the taste characteristics of the beer and the taste characteristics of the food having some sort of natural harmony. And that's something I talk about a lot. A few people have written books and articles about beer and food, but they haven't really gone into it in quite this way. This is really quite a passion of mine, and this book is very, it's a very, very detailed in its research and very detailed in its exposition, if you like. And the exposition is very personal. The book's written in the first person. None of my previous books were written in the first person. But I think after 15 or 20 years of writing about this topic, the time has come for me to say, well, look, this is what I think personally.
So then the book is, technically, it's officially titled Michael Jackson's Beer Companion.
Yes.
Very good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I could go on the entire day here.
Well, you know what you need.